Welcome to the Workflow Show. I'm Nick Gold, and I'm here with my cohort, Jason Whetstone.
Hello, everybody.
And this is episode 303, When to NAS and When to SAN.
Right.
The differences between a NAS, aka a file server, and a SAN, a storage area network.
Storage area network. And NAS is not the reverse of that, right?
NAS
stands for network attached storage.
It's not like God and dog or anything deep like that. It's more, well, it's a difference in the entire way you create a storage network. There's a lot of differences between the two. But we hit this all the time, right? Mm-hmm. Because both of these storage networking technologies are, number one, options for people who are doing collaborative video storage environments.
Right.
And yet they're very different technologies, even though at the end of the day, it's a not terribly sexy hard drive icon on your desktop.
Exactly.
But man, what goes into that hard drive icon? So important.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. There's a lot behind that little hard drive icon.
To your everyday user, one versus the other, looking at files in the Finder, it really doesn't fundamentally matter. One looks like one icon, one looks like another icon.
And if it's working well and it's well engineered, frankly, you don't want the user to ever think of it differently than any other hard drive icon on the desktop. It's there when they need it to be. It allows for the type of collaborative workflows that they may need to participate in with their colleagues as far as sharing of files, whether those are media files or project files, what have you. It needs to be compatible with the applications that they're using at a given moment.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be up to the performance tasks that the user needs. Does it have the read speeds and the write speeds that someone needs to be working with the formats of video and the type of projects that they happen to be finding themselves in at a given moment? And, it needs to be a reliable piece of storage. We talked about that. It's there when you want it to be. But, is it RAID protected? Is there backup systems behind it? Is it compatible with your media asset management environment? All of these things. But at the end of the day, a user shouldn't have to really even worry about what's behind that hard drive icon. You want to make that almost as obfuscated as possible. You don't want them to have to think about it other than that it's there, it's reliable, and it meets their needs.
Right.
That's for people like us to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
We got to make sure there's just the right kind of mojo in that hard drive icon for it to just do its thing day in, day
out. Absolutely. Are we talking about, 720p footage? Are we talking about 1080? Are we talking about 4K or 6K?
How many layers of simultaneous, video streams do you need to pull in that Premiere project, at once and keep up with those speed requirements? Are you doing live ingests? So, yes, we're not going to get into the details about all of those nuances today with every possible workflow.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to spend this time today talking about what truly are the differences between SAN technology, NAS technology, or aka file servers, when a user might opt for one versus the other, when is one clearly out of the realm of possibility for a particular environment, what goes into our thinking when we spec one out versus the other, or, as is sometimes the case, when we say, well, listen, you, Mr. or Mrs. Customer, who are asking us for a collaborative high-performance storage networking solution, well, you could go in the NAS direction, or you could go in the SAN direction. And there's a lot of, nuance into why a customer may go in one direction versus the other. So we're going to try to delve into this today so people can be armed with the knowledge to make the best decision both for the organization today and what's the right solution to build on, because, that hard drive icon may not be so special looking, but in some ways it is the foundation of your collaborative video environment.
So let's start with a NAS. I mean, if I go to my system prefs and I go into sharing and I turn sharing on and I give people the IP address of my machine or the name of my machine and they connect to it and it shows up on their desktop. There's that icon on the desktop. Is it, that's a NAS, right? I mean, I can edit off of that, right?
You're now a NAS,
right,
Mr. Whetstone? Your computer has become a NAS. So let's first explain what NAS means. NAS simply means network attached storage.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just another word for a thing that most people commonly refer to as a file server.
Right.
And so, yes, for many years, people have gone to the sharing preferences on their computer, whether it's a Windows or a Mac, and you can reshare some or all of the storage that might be inside of your machine or tethered to your machine across an Ethernet network. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what makes a NAS a NAS. This is using Ethernet networking technology, whether that's single gigabit Ethernet or the newer, faster 10 gigabit Ethernet. You know, NAS and file servers use Ethernet as the shared storage environment. Network switches, all of that is Ethernet-based. Now, Ethernet doesn't necessarily mean those copper cables that most of us do plug our computers into the walls with to get on the network when we're not doing wireless.
So you can have Ethernet over fiber then.
That's right. And that's, you know, it's an important thing to point out. When we talk about fiber, we sometimes mean it in several different ways, and we'll talk about it more in the SAN way in a few minutes. But you can use fiber optic cablings.
Yeah.
Those cablings is.
Yeah.
You can use fiber optic cables in an Ethernet network that plug into Ethernet switches that have special types of modules installed in them that allow them to connect to other systems via fiber optics versus those copper cables that have those RJ45 connectors at the end that we call twisted pair.
So fiber isn't necessarily fiber channel.
No,
is what you're saying.
Fiber channel we'll talk about later when we get to the SANs, but you can have fiber optics involved in Ethernet networks, and fiber optics, while they're not the only cable that supports 10 gig E for Ethernet networks, 10 gigabit Ethernet, we most commonly use fiber optic cables for 10 gigabit Ethernet networks.
And is that because of the distance?
Yeah, fiber is, it's both a bandwidth thing and a distance thing. Now, there more recently is a spec that actually uses the copper twisted pair, RJ45 terminated, you know, copper Ethernet cables to carry 10 gig Ethernet, but it's much more limited distance-wise than running that same protocol over a fiber optic cable.
Right, that makes sense.
So, but let's talk about what are you doing when you've turned on sharing on your computer and now it's available on the network as a SharePoint? Or in a more robust environment, you build a file server with its own block of storage that becomes the file server, a dedicated file server system that you're connecting to over an Ethernet network.
And that makes a lot more sense because you would want that machine to only be doing file sharing.
Yes, exactly. When we're building a shared storage system of any sort, it becomes a very dedicated system just to do that storage networking in people's environments. We don't tend to double duty it. It's not a workstation as well as
a
file server.
It or a, you know.
You know. And again, there's always some caveats here and there about particular environments and workflows, but you typically want your file server to be a dedicated piece of equipment. And this starts to get into the nuts and bolts of what a file server really is, and this will also differentiate it from a SAN. So a file server starts with a server. Again, in the case that you were outlining earlier, your computer becomes the server if you turn on the sharing.
Mm-hmm.
But in this environment, it's a dedicated server. You know, it's a computer. It has a CPU and RAM and a motherboard and, you know, all of the things that make a computer, but in a server form factor. It's typically something that's going to be rack mounted, although there are small office, home office servers that are more of like a little desktop form factor.
Yeah.
And that's important because the server is running, you know, an operating system, number one. That's often, you know, it could be a Mac Mini running OS X. That's less common for us these days. It could be a Windows server with its Windows file sharing turned on.
Windows. Huh.
We do it. I know.
I mean, at the root, it's a server that's sharing out a file system.
Exactly. So. And often for us now, file servers that we build for video workgroup environments are running some variant of Linux. There's a particular commercial variant of Linux called OpenE that we use on the file server appliance type of boxes that we tend to sell.
And OpenE is a version of Linux that is tuned specifically for storage boxes, basically.
Yes,
so.
And it can share storage out in several ways, but one of the ways it does that is through file services. And so you have to think about, you know, imagine a server. There's this computer. that has an operating system and some software that runs on it, typically as part of the operating system, that are there specifically to share storage out to other users so that they can utilize it by hitting it across an Ethernet network or even, you know, the internet at large, theoretically, if you're VPNing in or something. And that's a set of software services that are running. And that file server, that computer that's running the file services, the NAS box itself, it has a block of storage attached to it. Now, that block of storage that the NAS box has, it is the machine that's directly connected to that storage.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what that server that sits on top of that storage does is it essentially presents a virtualized version of the file system that's actually running on that storage that turns it into a block of addressable storage instead of just a bunch of hard drives sitting under the hood.
Hmm. Virtual. So when I hear the word virtual, I tend to think the machine is doing something at the same time as it's doing that, whatever that virtual thing is. So I think a little bit slower, maybe?
Well, exactly. Think about this. When you connect to a file server from your computer and a little shared drive icon comes up on your desktop, it has that little icon. I think on OS X, it's like the little people holding hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a network share, but it looks like a volume. It looks like a drive icon. And so it's tempting to think about it like it's just another hard drive you've plugged in.
Right.
But it isn't. You want to know what it is, Jason?
What is it?
A lie.
It's lies.
It is. It's just a lie. It's a lie because as you write files to that thing that looks like a drive icon, you copy data to it, you ingest video, you render something out to it, it's tempting to think that you are addressing that storage directly, but you're
right.
Not.
Because it's a virtualized file system.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What you are really doing is talking to the file server computer over the network using one of several common file sharing protocols that we use. Typical one these days is called SMB/SIFS, C-I-F-S.
Right.
And SIFS is, for a while, was kind of the default Windows file sharing protocol, but nowadays even Macs kind of use it as the default because it's pretty industry standard. Another one that we sometimes use is called NFS, which has its roots in kind of Linux and Unix-based operating systems as their file sharing technology. But you seeing that drive on your desktop is kind of this virtual drive that the file server is representing to your client system, your connected workstation, as if it were a volume of storage that you can directly address. But really, that's not true. The thing that writes the data to that underlying storage in the file server is the file server's computer itself running those file services.
Yeah. So it's almost like a middleman.
It's a perfect way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. It is a middleman. It is saying, well, you're really kind of transferring data to me at a really high speed, and then I'm going to write it to my underlying storage that really I'm the only one who's directly addressing. But I'm going to kind of trick you into feeling like you're doing it and it might suffice for your purposes. So probably I'd say maybe 5 years back when computers weren't as fast, we didn't have very highly optimized operating systems that were very attuned to working specifically as file servers. When networking switches, especially the lower price switches, you know, hundreds or several thousand dollar range, just weren't as good and efficient. When a lot of factors weren't kind of fully baked in the way that they are today, we were very reticent to use file servers and the underlying storage that they were kind of virtually presenting to clients as real-time video production storage volumes. Because
is that because of the speed or?
The speed, and again, the speed and latency, because it's important to kind of differentiate between the sheer throughput as one metric of speed and latency. Are there little hiccups involved in another? Well, back then, we were very conservative about it because both the act of this file server acting as a mediator to the underlying storage could affect both throughput speeds and latencies causing hiccups. And for real-time video ingest, for instance, which was a lot more common 5 or 6 years ago before file-based workflows just almost completely took over, even little hiccups could mean dropped frames.
Sure.
plus 10 gigabit Ethernet really wasn't even an option at that point, largely for price reasons and just availability of equipment. So we were squeezed into these 1 gigabit pipes universally. And for like all of these reasons, we didn't think NASes, file servers, were suitable production storage.
Well, what about link aggregation?
So link aggregation was one way we dealt with this back in the day. Link aggregation is a way of taking several independent Ethernet links, cables really. So picture kind of the file server as one box and your Ethernet switch as another box in the middle, and it's got some connections.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Ethernet switch goes out to all of your clients, right?
Right.
Well, to open up some of the bandwidth between potential bottlenecks, and a lot of that time the bottleneck was between the file server itself and the switch.
Sure, because you have one pipe going to the switch and then...
Exactly. To open that pipe up, we would aggregate multiple single gigabit connections together so there was enough bandwidth between the actual storage system and the Ethernet switching environment. So all the sets of users who might need to connect to it at once would have enough aggregate bandwidth between them to get to the storage at the same time, and people aren't kind of taking up the bandwidth. However, something that happened, one of the trends that changed, I'd say, over the last 5 years or so, is that 10 gigabit Ethernet became much more viable. So we don't have to aggregate individual gigabit links anymore to increase bandwidth across any part of this kind of network. We could have one or several 10 gig links between a file server and a switch that has maybe a handful of 10 gig ports, and then have a bunch of clients connected via single gigabit ports. And, you know, that opened up a lot of bottlenecks. Plus, we have better file servers now, you know, the better switches. There's a lot less of both of those latency hiccups and just throughput bottlenecks. And so we've gotten to a point that file servers can give users, potentially, if it's well engineered, with some caveats, we'll get into that, you know, enough bandwidth to do actual editing off of.
Sure. It sounds like, I mean, it sounds like if you really do have a tuned box that's really made for sharing files, it could be a pretty powerful system.
Yes. And so that's an important thing, right? You can buy a Drobo that presents itself out as a file server and say, well, you know, I could edit off of this because I can mount it on my desktop and, you know, some applications will be able to use it.
Sure.
But the problem is it's not designed for that. You know, there's a lot of prosumer, you know, small office, home office, Soho, you know, type NAS boxes that maybe a single user could do some very basic cutting off of. But the moment it needs to be kind of the foundational element of a workgroup, collaborative, high-performance production storage system, can tell I've said that phrase in various iterations about 400 million times in my life, right? But they're not going to cut it. They're going to fall apart under pressure. Those things are for hosting a few files in a small office environment that you're not needing to manipulate in real time and have high bandwidth requirements associated
with
it.
Probably not talking about video.
It's not streams of 100 to 200 megabit ProRes files of which you need to be pulling 3 per workstation simultaneously across a workgroup of 6 to 15 users, you know?
Right.
Those things are going to fall apart for that. So a well-engineered system, we tend to build our own, right? We spec out all the hardware down to the subcomponent. We choose the RAID controller cards, the hard drives. We run OpenE on it. We spec it out. We make sure there's enough bandwidth between what this unit will be and the Ethernet switch environment that all the clients will connect to it through to meet an environment's needs. And it can work.
Sure.
But there's caveats.
Like, I can think of one. What happens to the trash can?
The trash can.
Yeah. So what happens when you want to throw away a file on a NAS?
That's a good question. What does happen when you want to throw away a file?
I can tell you. You get a little dialog box that pops up and says, are you sure you want to delete this file? It will be gone for good. And if you say yes, then the file will go away. It doesn't go into the trash can or the recycling bin. It just goes away. It's gone.
And this is part of that byproduct of the fact that you're working with a virtualized operating system. It doesn't work exactly the same way built in what we call direct attached storage does. Storage that is being locally addressed by your computer through a standard file system in the Mac. That's usually HFS Plus or the Mac OS Extended File System. That's not what you're interacting with a NAS. There is a file system under the hood, but the only box that's really touching the file system directly is the file server. So things like that behave differently. But there's also a lot of performance ramifications still, even with all the improvements.
Well, let's talk about this for a moment. You talked about 10 gigabit Ethernet, right?
Yes.
So I've heard, you know, a SAN really, like, you know, we're not getting really speeds above 4 to 8.
Sure.
So wouldn't a 10 gig Ethernet link be faster?
Well, let's rewind. Let's talk about single gig, because a single gigabit Ethernet, from especially the clients to the Ethernet switch that acts as the switch that, you know, bridges the clients to the NAS, a lot of environments we're doing, it's still single gig connectivity between those clients and that switch.
Right.
And some of that's for cost reasons. They don't want to run the fiber optics that 10 gig requires.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk a little bit more about some of the networking stuff, but just as far as the speed of the gigabit, right?
Right.
Gigabit in real world scenarios on a user by user basis, and this assumes that the back end of the system is well engineered, is functioning properly, that it's a dedicated Ethernet network. This is an important point.
Oh, dedicated Ethernet network. So not the same one you hit with,
yes,
Safari and are watching YouTube.
Correct.
And all that kind of stuff.
Whether you use, you know, Wi-Fi for your general network access, or you have an Ethernet port, you know, on a gigabit or a 10/100 network that gives you access to the internet, you know, your mail server.
Maybe a company file server,
whatever,
separate from your,
right,
media server.
Directory,
like,
services,
sure,
whether it's Active Directory or Open Directory. That's not the network we're going to use for the shared storage network for video production purposes, because we don't want all the other traffic on that network. I'm pulling down a web page, I'm updating OS X, whatever it is. We don't want that traffic to in any way, shape, or form get in the way of the video traffic that needs to meet certain real-time performance metrics. So when we do a file server, a NAS, using Ethernet file sharing as a workgroup storage system, we will run it as a totally separate network from your general network. And that often means your client workstation will need a second gigabit run connected to it, going to, mm-hmm, usually a dedicated switch that, again, is just to connect clients to the video shared storage NAS.
Okay.
And, again, that's one of the best practices that we've developed over years of doing this stuff, because, again, we found that the moment you're kind of trying to combine general networking stuff and this video-specific networking, again, that's one of the things that can create more issues.
It clamps on the bandwidth. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people are still using single gig. And single gig, in the best possible situation, the shared storage system itself is high performance and can meet the aggregate needs of all of the users at once. It's on a dedicated network. There isn't a performance bottleneck between the NAS itself and the switch.
Mm-hmm.
And that if single gig is how the clients are connecting to it, your performance is going to be about akin to editing off of a 2-drive RAID 0 FireWire 800 drive, like,
okay,
a G-RAID or a LaCie. These are one of the desktop drives that actually have 2 hard drives built in, and because it uses RAID 0, which is a stripe across those 2 drives, it's going to combine some of the performance and all of the space of those 2 physical hard drive mechanisms, and you're just going to see it as a single icon on your desktop, a single drive.
Right.
And gigabit Ethernet is, on paper, a little bit faster than the 800 megabits a second that a FireWire 800, that's the 800,
mm-hmm,
and FireWire 800,
yep,
gives you. And frankly, a lot of the time is the little RAID controller chips that are doing the RAID 0 in one of those desktop drives aren't the most high performance things in the world. There's a lot of bottlenecks with a lot of the FireWire 800 chipsets that are out there that actually turn the drive into a FireWire 800 device. So really, in best world conditions, a gigabit connection to a well-engineered NAS on a dedicated network is going to probably net you a little bit better performance than connecting to a 2-drive RAID 0 FireWire 800 drive on your desktop. You know, I'll use megabytes a second just to confuse things, but I don't know. We kind of go back and forth.
We go back and forth.
Bits,
yeah,
and bytes. Just remember, folks, a bit is 1/8 of a byte. A byte is 8 bits, so that's how you do the math there. It's about all the arithmetic my mind is able to handle, and usually that requires a calculator. But let's talk about megabytes a second. So a FireWire 800 drive, I've often seen like a read speed on those top out at like 60 to 70 megabytes a second. Mm-hmm. In a gigabit environment, we see those read speeds off of the shared storage system probably more in that 70 to 85 megabytes a second. Mm-hmm. And so what do you get over that? Assuming, again, everything is all right in the world. Well, that's probably just, we talk about guarantees. We try to throw kind of conservative numbers out there, right? ProRes, standard ProRes, ProRes 422. You'll probably be able to pull in real time 3 HD ProRes 422 streams over a gigabit Ethernet connection.
Are we talking like 720, 720p?
Whether it's 720, 60, or 1080, you know, 5994 frame fields rather. So maybe like 1080p 30 or i5994 or 720p 60. You'll probably get 3 streams of that in real time through that connection. If you move up to the HQ variant of ProRes, you're probably talking about only a guaranteed 2 streams. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about stream counts and why it may be better to have more streams, you really, users need to think about their video projects. This is something that is very specific to NLEs, to video editing, After Effects, because it caches so much in RAM and things like that. It doesn't stress the storage in the same way that, you know, video editing itself does.
It's also not real time usually.
Exactly. Yeah. But what's real time when you're editing, right? So people tend to know that when you render out, right, you're basically running, you know, your project file is essentially an instruction sheet, right? It's a recipe. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right? That's all a project file is. It's a recipe. And the stuff that you're manipulating, you're never destructively manipulating the constituent elements and video files and graphics and you know, photos that are part of your editing project, right? Those are non-destructively being kind of run through this set of directions.
They're referenced.
And what you do create or spit out whenever you render is a render file.
Right.
And a render file kind of takes that raw stuff, runs it through your instructions or your recipe, and spits something out afterwards. But these days, NLEs, nonlinear editing programs like Premiere, Final Cut 10, or even back in Final Cut 7 days, were really good at doing kind of real-time renders in the background that could show you what an effect was going to look like, a graphic was going to look like, picture-in-picture video was going to look like. And what it did is it and continues to do is really real-time rendering in the background. But it's not spitting out a new file. It's doing it in the background using your computer's processing power.
So you don't have to wait for that render.
Exactly. And so what happens, though, as a result, is when you're previewing these kind of things, you haven't flattened everything out into a single layer of video in the way that if you do a render all command and it actually creates true dedicated render files, you're getting. Because when you render something out, you're flattening all the constituent layers down to a single file. And so you only need to be able to pull one layer's worth of video performance in order to view it. But before you render, you're potentially having to pull multiple streams of video at the same time in real time. So I think the easiest way for people to think of this is like your typical cross-dissolve, right?
Sure.
Think about your project. You might have 20 layers of video, but what we're really talking about here is those moments in the project that based on effects and other things that you're doing, there's multiple layers of video actually playing to screen at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so think about a cross-dissolve, right? You got one video and then another video, but there's like 3 seconds where they're overlaid because there's a dissolve going on between one and the other. Well, while you're just previewing those effects before you actually do a true render to generate a little separate file that represents that kind of intermediary period, you're actually having to pull both of those streams of video at the same time for the 3 seconds of that overlap.
Okay, so it's not just like me opening up 3 different videos in the Finder and or in QuickTime Player and playing them all alongside each other.
That would have those types of performance requirements, right?
But all I'm saying is it's something that actually affects users as they're editing.
Exactly, right? Because the moment it stops being able to pull the performance for those 3 seconds during that cross dissolve of both streams at once, you will get dropped frames on playback. Now, dropped frames on playback can or you know, they may or may not be really harmful. If it's dropping like tons of frames, it may be so bad you can't even really tell if that effect is working properly. If, you know, it's just one dropped frame because it just quickly had to stutter, if you turn those warnings off, you might not even visually see that the dropped frame occur on playback. Of course, on ingest, dropped frames are a real pain because you may only have that one shot to ingest something, right?
Well, wait a second, though, Nick. What about now, we have a lot of clients that are getting away from tape-based workflows, but what about those clients that need to deliver tapes to TV stations or, you know, broadcast
and
avenues?
There are still people who ingest, especially for legacy materials, right? People are going to be ingesting off a tape for decades just because of all the legacy materials that they've accumulated.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, that's another time where you need to make sure that the performance of the write speed to the shared storage system you're on can keep up with the one stream of video that you're ingesting. And most shared storage systems and storage in general has slightly slower write speeds than read speeds.
Mm-hmm.
So you do need to bear that in mind. But the reality is, you know, I said that like you can get two streams of ProRes HQ or maybe three streams of ProRes, regular ProRes 422 for a read off of a file server. You're probably not going to have a problem ingesting one stream of that. Right. And if you're using lower bitrate codecs like XDCAM 35 or 50, you know, your performance metrics are even lower. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can fit 2 to 3 times one of those streams in the bandwidth of a single stream of ProRes or ProRes HQ. So gigabit might be borderline for you if you have a ProRes workflow, but might be very easy for you to work with if the top codec you're ever using is 50 megabit a second XDCAM HD off of an SBIS card. So, you know, you really need to think through the codecs, the number of layers your projects may call for. You know, picture the Brady Bunch thing, right? Even if you had like a
9 different streams of video on the same.
Yeah, exactly. Like before you render that, that's going to have to pull 9 streams simultaneously. Hmm. So you have to multiply the bit rate of one stream times the number of streams. And that'll tell you, do you have enough headroom in your connection to the shared storage, assuming all of those streams are on that same shared storage device, to even be able to pull them through without it going crazy and dropping frames.
Or without you having to send it to Motion Graphics.
And what we find is most of our clients, I think, are pretty comfortable. They say, well, normally we're 2 to 3, and maybe projects get crazy if they're at 5 streams at once pre-render, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so a client has to ask themselves, well, what if I told you over this gigabit connection, if you're typically working in ProRes HQ, say, I can guarantee that you'll probably be able to preview a cross-dissolve or any two-layer thing without having to render.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you start getting into 3+ layers at once, you're probably going to have to do a render command to flatten it out into that single file.
Mm-hmm.
So it lowers the bandwidth requirements. So, you know, the thing about gigabit and NASes is that people have to think about it still. It's
sure.
not enough bandwidth in today's day and age with HD being totally common, and even with things like 4K plus kind of hitting. You can't really do stuff with 4K materials adequately, maybe one layer, maybe over a gigabit connection. So gigabit still requires some thinking, which is one reason,
sure.
you know, we hate thinking around here. And so, no, but seriously, like, if you have to think about it, even around today's requirements, you know that that's probably going to represent a fairly low ceiling on you for tomorrow's endeavors.
Sure.
And you were talking about 10 gig. Well, now that we have 10 gig, what if we just have enough 10 gig pipes between the NAS and that dedicated video network Ethernet switch to give you enough back-end performance to sustain the entire work group working at once, and then you run 10 gig out to the individual client workstations?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that helps mm-hmm. a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you way more headroom.
Sure.
It doesn't give you 10 times as much, though, as the pure numbers on the paper would seem to indicate. Because remember we were talking earlier about all of those different latencies and overheads associated with Ethernet networks, the file sharing protocols we use, the fact that you're going through a file server head node. This is essentially a virtualized file system that you're interacting with. Some of that headroom still comes into play, even if you open that pipe up. So what we tell people, again, it's probably a little on the conservative side. And again, this is all dependent on the back end of the system being well engineered and there being enough
dedicated
total bandwidth between the file server and the switch to sustain everyone. But with all that said, even if all that's in place, really there's probably, people should only count on maybe a 4 to 6 time or roughly 5 times improvement of performance to a client workstation from going from 1 gig to 10 gig.
So not 10 times performance or even 9 times performance.
But the reality even is, even 5 times performance is a lot. That starts to get it into a zone where from a bandwidth perspective, you don't have to think as often.
Right.
You know, now that it's 6-7 streams of ProRes or ProRes HQ or even more with lower bitrate codecs over 10 gig, it's like, well, I'm not going to have to think about that because those are some real outlier scenarios that I might have a project that calls for that, right?
Right.
Here's the flip side, though. 10 gig is still much more expensive than single gig. We've got some cheaper switches that we can do that maybe have 4 10-gig ports and like max out at 4 10-gig ports.
And they have a bunch of single gig ports.
And then they'll have a bunch of single gig ports. And we typically are doing HPs because we find that they work well in the real world, but they're a low enough cost where it's not a, you know, mind bender for folks.
Yeah.
But, you know, that gives you up to 4 10-gig ports and, you know, up to 48 single gig ports. Well, we're going to typically recommend that you have at least 2 10-gig ports going between your NAS and that dedicated video
switch.
Ethernet switch.
Right.
So that at most leaves you 2 more 10 gigs to run to your client workstations. Those client workstations will need to be outfitted with 10 gig E cards.
Right.
Or these days, Thunderbolt boxes.
Box.
It's basically a 10 gig port on one side to connect to that fiber optic cable probably and go to that switch. And on the other side, it just gives you a Thunderbolt connector to connect to your Mac via Thunderbolt.
Right.
We also have PCIe card versions to install into older Macs or Windows machines. But those things are, you know, not free.
I'm thinking probably along the lines of what it would cost to plug in a fiber channel.
Yeah, they're not much different than the cost of a fiber channel interface. And here's the other rub, right? To use a Brian Suma phrase. here's the rub.
Here's the rub, yes. He likes to use that Shakespearean phrase.
I know, right? He's such a theatrical guy. Although, I guess he doesn't hold a candle to you.
Well, thank you.
You're Mr. Theater.
You know. Thank you, Nick.
He was doing some voices before we started recording. I was very impressed. He could go into
Charlton Heston. Yes. Nick, tell me what the difference between a SAN and a NAS is today.
Yeah, exactly. Now I feel like I'm really on the spot. So here's the rub. The moment you need a switch that either out of the gate has more than 4 10-gig ports or maybe even has like, you know, a dozen of them or 20 of them or whatever it may be that you need, you're starting to get into a class of Ethernet switch that it's much cheaper than it was a few years ago.
Sure.
But it still ain't cheap, right?
So
we're typically using Cisco's that come with 8 10-gig ports on board and then have these 2 other module slots that can either be per slot 20 single gigabit ports or 8 more 10-gig ports. And so maybe we have a work group that really needs a total of 8 10-gig ports and some single gig for other connections, and we'll have to sell one of those switches with the 20-port single gig module board installed.
So you can mix these connections in your environment.
Absolutely.
You can say, like, maybe these 2 editors over here need a 10-gig connection and everybody else can have a single gig.
Absolutely, okay. Right? And, you know, it is important if someone is looking at a NAS and, you know, is having a conversation with us to determine, well, do I need single gig for this user? Can I get away with, you know, that? Or do I absolutely need 10 gig? Maybe I've got like a couple of producer workstations that are doing at most some cuts editing or very light stuff. And then I've got a couple of like primary rooms that do the more complicated stuff. Well, maybe you can get away with a cheaper Ethernet switch that has 4 10-gig ports, 2 of them going to the NAS, 2 of them going to the high caliber workstations, and then a number of the gigabit ports, single gig, going to the less robust systems.
Mm-hmm.
We do that all the time. And a conversation with us can pretty quickly determine what that is, as long as we know what are the codecs you're working with, what is the complexity of the projects, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
So, but a totally 10 gig NAS based system because largely of the cost of that switch that's going to be necessary to give you a good number of 10 gig ports, it starts to get a little pricier than a lot of people realize. They're like, I thought I was saving money with Ethernet. And it's like, well, you needed a lot of 10 gig and that's still...
needed a lot of 10 gig. Hey, what about adding things like transcoders? Like what if I want to put a... you know, an elemental or an episode box or something like that on a system like...
or a MAM or an archive system.
An application server for a MAM, something like that. I mean, we're starting to look at other machines maybe needing some higher speed or just a little bit more horsepower to access that storage.
Well, again, that's where an even deeper look at workflow is going to be necessary, mm-hmm. right? Because we have to determine to those various systems doing their thing. Maybe it's a tape archive server. So mm-hmm. it's running something like Archiware Archive and it or you know, a Tempo Digital Archive or you know, one of many different tape archive packages, you know, Zen Data or Storage DNA or mm-hmm. whatever, right? It is going to need to mostly read data off of the storage system and then write it to tape, that it is typically going to be hosting directly itself, you know, because it's going to be tethered to a tape library or a tape drive, right?
Right.
Well, we know that tape drives write at certain speeds, and the reality is even a single tape drive can be written to at faster than the speed that box will be able to read off of the NAS if it's only connected via single gigabit connection.
Oh, right.
You know, mm-hmm, so then you get thrown in a tape library that has three or four drives and they all may be reading and writing at the same time, depending on certain types of operations that may be going on. That single gig port will be a bottleneck.
Right.
And it won't go as fast as it normally would unless you give it a 10 gig port. So we will often put archive servers on a 10 gig link to a NAS or the switch that acts as the intermediary to the NAS. We will often put MAM systems on a 10 gig port because it may have to do broad ingesting of assets, moving assets around, bouncing assets between itself and an archive system.
Transcoding assets.
Transcoding. Mm-hmm. Transcoders. Transcoders by themselves, if you have like an episode engine, that's kind of an area where we have to think about it a little bit. Because one of the things about things that move files and transcode files, file movement will typically saturate a link. Right. If I'm copying something using, you know, some box as an intermediary, even a client workstation here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Or some part of a MAM system that might automatically be moving files based on certain, you mm-hmm. know, criteria being met. As long as the storage system or systems it's connected to can sustain the speeds behind the scenes based on the number of drives and just the speed of the storage
sure.
system in general, but
it'll just kind of grab whatever it can.
It'll grab and it'll mm-hmm. suck as much data off that transfer is occurring and saturate a 1 gig link or saturate a 10 gig link. That can now have performance ramifications
sure.
to the users who are maybe simultaneously using that storage system because the storage system only has so much performance in terms of reads and writes to dole out.
Right.
And so anything that suddenly is just mass reading data off of it, because say a file is being transferred off of the system, or mass writing data to it because the file is being copied onto the system or ingested onto the system, it can potentially saturate those connections
sure.
in a way that an editor typically wouldn't even through normal video editing operations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing we have to look at. Transcoders are kind of a funny use case because depending on the nature of the jobs, the transcodes, the codecs, whether it's a bunch of smaller parallelized jobs that are happening simultaneously versus one big job, it may or may not be disk speed that is a bottleneck to those particular transcoding operations.
Okay, so it could be the transcode itself that's the bottleneck.
So maybe
the transcoder can't read the files.
Or write them. But, you know, what we found, and this was a little bit of a surprise to me probably a couple of years ago, is we started to realize, I thought we were well still at the point where transcodes were typically bottlenecked by CPU, you know, your processing power
mm-hmm.
and transcoders that do use CPUs as their main transcode engine, or, you know, in the case of GPU accelerated transcoders like Elemental, that the GPUs still really represented the bottleneck for a lot of the type of transcode jobs. So we would never get into a situation of having to saturate our link to the storage with either reads or writes, because, gosh, isn't this stuff still really bound down by processing power?
Right.
Well, it turns out that that's actually not the case a lot of the time these days, that a lot of the performance now that the processing power and that, you know, we have single boxes that may have 20 cores that act like a 40-core
sure.
machine.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking the other day about Intel's next generation of Xeon chips. They're going to have one that's 18 physical cores per chip that act like 36 because of the hyperthreading function of these CPUs. And you can have two of them in a single rack U box. So it's like having a 72-core computer in a single rack unit of rack space.
So imagine putting any kind of multi-threaded transcoding engine on
something
like that.
Something like Episode Engine.
Yeah.
They scream.
Yeah.
There's been way more advancements, you know, in the last 5 years in CPU than, well, maybe I'm still stuck on the same gigabit connection mm-hmm. that I was 5 years ago, right?
Right.
And so the speed to the storage has started to matter much more for transcoding operations than sometimes the horsepower of the transcoder
sure.
itself.
Yeah.
Because they can just chug through so much more work because it's like having 20 or 30 machines in one now, that link to the storage becomes the bottleneck. But that might be good. You may want to like hamstring the transcoder so it doesn't completely bog down the read-write performance of the underlying storage system just through doing transcoding activities. You don't want that to disrupt an editor. You mm-hmm. may decide we need a separate silo for transcoding, completely separated from the storage system that's being used for the editors,
mm-hmm.
or at least a dedicated set of drives in a file server box that is reshared as a separate share specifically for transcoding purposes. Because if we had the transcoder saturating a 10 gig link, that might, you know, dramatically impact the real-time editing environment, and people are suddenly
sure.
dropping frames and like, what the hell is going on? No one's editing all sorts of crazy stuff, and it's like, ooh, we got that transcode job.
Well, one of the applications I can think of right off the top of my head would be like a MAM doing proxy transcodes. That's happening most of the time as ingests are happening.
Exactly. So MAMs are, you know, sucking that down and you know, definitely having a toll mm-hmm. on both the read and write performance of the underlying storage system. So
splitting that out into a separate pool of storage
could be good. I mean, again, it's not always necessary. These are things that people have to look at when mm-hmm. they look at, you know, the totality of the system. Can it keep up? Do we want to artificially limit anyone's links to it by putting them on single gig instead of 10 gig? Lot of different things we have to consider.
Right.
So, you know, those are NASs. There are definitely some bottlenecks and overheads. You know, another thing we didn't talk about are these protocols, right? The way in which the file server virtualizes the file system.
So we're talking NFS, SMB SIFS, AFP even?
We don't use AFP as much anymore because it was the Apple-centric one that
sure.
even Apple has kind of given up on.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the world has come down to NFS. And I should mention, Macs support both of these from the client
mm-hmm.
side.
Mm-hmm.
So you have NFS if you want a more old school Unix-y style one, and SMB SIFS, which is a little more new school and Apple has kind of adopted as the standard. Well, here's the thing. From a client perspective, first of all, connecting to those shares isn't exactly the same process depending on which you're working with. It's not like there are ways to work around this with some third-party software and, you know, some scripting and all of that. But it's not like you turn on your machine and, you know, the built-in hard drive is there and the NAS just automatically appears there. There may be a procedure a user has to use to connect to it.
Sure.
Again, we can automate this, but there's still differences. And the reality is SMB SIFS from a client perspective is a little nicer to work with from what I understand. It's a little more natural. I think it's a little easier for us to auto mount an SMB SIFS
sure
share
yes.
when a user logs in than an NFS share. So someone might be like, well, why would you ever use this kind of bare bones NFS thing at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's actually because it's bare bones. We find that NFS, you know, SMB SIFS has gotten a lot better. There's a new version in the very latest builds of OS X that seems to improve performance on the client side.
Sure.
But we tend to find that NFS universally is the fastest because it's so basic and so stripped down. And there are particular apps that don't respect or even allow you to work with an SMB SIFS share, but
okay.
do work with NFS, Final Cut 10 being a huge one.
Okay.
So granted, you know, not a ton of our users in shared work group you know, storage environments are using Final Cut 10, but there are some.
Sure.
And if you're going to use Final Cut 10 with shared NAS storage, you have to connect to the NAS using NFS, at least as of today. Maybe that could change in the future. My thinking is that Apple probably did it because the performance of NFS tends to be a little better. It's it's because it's a little more bare bones as far as some of the deeper level functionality that these file sharing protocols can offer. For instance, with SMB SIFS, you can set up its own set of users and groups, so you can kind of apply permissions using SMB SIFS itself,
right,
and set up users or groups for permission purposes on the file server. NFS doesn't work that way. NFS would require that you have a separate directory services system.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you have Final Cut 10, you're going to need to use NFS, but it doesn't have its own set of permissions, so you'll need directory services if you want to, you know, rule who can manipulate, you know, content in specific directories or which group of users. So yeah, there's just a lot of considerations.
You know, that's a whole other discussion entirely. Like I hear a lot of users and admins saying, "Well, we just want to have our SAN wide open." You know,
yeah, that could be a whole other episode.
We sure could
write that one down. The users, groups, permissions, directory services.
Well, I find permissions to be one of the biggest misunderstood children of the.
I'd say it's 50% of the support phone
video
calls.
Production IT. Yeah,
50% of our support phone calls in some way relate to permissions. Mm-hmm. So we will address that in a future one. But
sure.
Permission systems do have an impact when you're putting together a NAS or a SAN system. So again, you know, we talked about the NASs. There's the file protocols, there's the latencies, there's 1 gig versus 10 gig, there's having it on a dedicated Ethernet network that isn't your general Ethernet network,
mm-hmm.
having a well-constructed file server behind the scenes. There's just a lot of stuff to it, and it requires some thought, and yet we now know how to execute them pretty well, and they are a viable choice. So that leaves...
Now let's talk about the SAN. Mr. Gold, tell us what the difference is between a NAS and a SAN.
Yes. So they're not just the opposite of one another, despite them being the same three letters in a different order. So NAS was network attached storage and represents a virtualized file system that a file server is sharing out and tricking you into believing that you're manipulating directly.
Mm-hmm.
A SAN sounds very similar, sort of. It's a storage area network.
Ah.
A storage area network. I don't know who came up with that name,
well,
by the way.
Well, that definitely implies something a little bit different than, what we just talked about.
I don't know. I'll put it this way. It does in that a NAS is a network-attached storage device. And, you know, a NAS, when we talk about a NAS, we're talking about that box on an Ethernet network that's acting as a file server.
Sure.
With a SAN, I think you're actually right, right? With a SAN is the entire network, including the storage.
Right.
It is a network that is exclusively used for storage. It is purely a storage networking technology.
What I've said before is bringing a SAN into your environment, it's really changing your environment entirely. So, you know, you think of a storage area network, you are... essentially giving everybody a local hard drive that they can all share.
Well, and that's like the first big difference, right? Because
right.
we talked about how a file server at the end of the day is lying to you.
Sure.
A SAN is not a lie. A SAN is truth. It is the essence of truth.
Well, that's deep.
I know. Nick. I'm a deep guy.
Yeah, yeah.
We should talk about some deep stuff sometime.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So, but really, a SAN is not a lie because it works very differently than a file server. We'll talk about the building blocks of the actual network side of a SAN in a little bit, but here's the heart of it. And once again, I have to thank Brian Suma, our intrepid, mm-hmm. you know, senior video and media storage systems engineer who's been here for like
15 years,
100 years.
Yeah. Something
you know,
like that.
It's pretty old school.
Yeah.
But you know, Brian explained it best to me one day. He said, you know, with a file server, you're having to write to the storage through the file server. With a SAN, clients are actually interacting with the underlying storage directly. When you mount a SAN drive on your desktop, you are writing to the storage. You are manipulating the file system directly. It is not a virtualized file system. It's a specialized file system. It's not the same file system you use for a local storage device like your built-in hard drive or a Thunderbolt or a FireWire USB drive.
So it is a file system, though.
It's running a SAN file system, right? Mm-hmm. The one we use most often these days is really called StoreNext. Mm-hmm. It's also known as XSAN when you happen to be interacting with it from a Mac.
Right.
But XSAN and StoreNext, despite some kind of versioning things, they're really the same thing. It's kind of like the Mac version of Microsoft Office versus the Windows version of Microsoft Office. It's Microsoft Office. The document types are interchangeable. Well, in a SAN, it's StoreNext when it's a Linux or Windows server hosting the SAN. We'll talk about what that means in a little bit. Or a Windows or Linux or Unix client connecting to the SAN. They run a piece of software called StoreNext.
Right.
On a Mac, if you're hosting a StoreNext SAN or connecting to a StoreNext SAN, the piece of software you do that with is called XSAN. And for several years, XSAN has actually just been bundled into the operating system.
Yeah, since Lion, as a matter of fact.
10.7, Lion. I can't believe I remembered that 10.7 was Lion. Just can't keep all these cats straight. I'm so glad we're into
landmarks in California.
Right. That's great.
So how does that work, Nick? Is that like, you say it's a piece of software. Is that something I have to open to be able to work
it's
with this file system?
It's kind of running in the background. And, another nice thing is that, we can set a SAN volume up to just auto mount it, log in, and, user doesn't have to do anything, right?
That's actually been my experience with every SAN I've ever encountered.
Yeah, you turn on your computer.
There's the SAN.
And again, it does act a bit more like real storage that you're interacting with than a file share for a file server, because it is. Mm-hmm. I'll explain how the magic of multiple people writing to local, what essentially amounts to something that the computer thinks of as local storage, how that all works in a moment. But that's a nice thing just to kind of think about. There is no intermediary system. There's a lot of performance benefits to this, latency benefits to it.
Sure.
It's less layers of, in some ways, less layers of complexity. There is a lot of complexity behind a SAN.
Yeah. And there is a trash can.
Oh, is there?
Yes. Yes. When you delete files off of your Mac, do it the same way you delete any other file. You drag it to the trash or press Command Delete. And it goes into the trash.
And that's largely
because...
you can
go back in there and get it back out if you need to.
And that's largely because of how XSAN itself, as client software to StoreNext SANs, has been written by Apple, right?
Right.
They wanted to make the experience of interacting with XSAN or StoreNext as seamless as possible, because Apple was really pushing it quite heavily for a while. Not as much anymore, but... XSAN is almost only used on the client side now. We typically host a StoreNext SAN on Linux servers running the StoreNext software. But again, a Mac uses XSAN built into the operating system to connect to it. But Apple has still tried to make that experience as seamless as possible to your average Mac user.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be a Windows user connecting to a StoreNext SAN running the StoreNext software or Linux, etc. And we do that. But most of our clients are using Macs to connect to it. That's what they're doing their video editing or their graphics on. And they don't even have to think about an extra thing to buy. We have to do a little configuration, but it's built right in there, right? But you may be asking, well, how is it that multiple computers can be writing to a file system at the same time?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
You can't have multiple users, The only way you can do that with a NAS is because you don't actually technically have multiple users writing to the file system at once.
It's kind of like a mail room or something like that, where you have one person sorting all the mail.
That is such a good analogy.
We didn't really use that analogy when we were talking about NASs a few minutes ago. It's kind of like handing all of the packages to one person in the postal in the mail department, and they have to figure out what to do with them.
Is running around with the cart.
Yeah.
Things are flying off the sides.
Sure, but not in a SAN though. And in a SAN, the users can put the packages where they belong.
Yes. So how is that possible? Because one of the things about file systems is most file systems aren't designed for multiple people to be interacting with, especially writing data to at the same time. Typically, with most file systems, that leads to corruption.
Right.
That makes the whole thing go belly up. So there's a couple ways that this was addressed by StoreNext and XSAN. So with StoreNext, number one, the software that runs the file system itself is designed to have multiple users writing to it at the same time. But there's kind of a key ingredient there. It's everyone is writing the data for themselves, but I guess I could say there is still a central orchestrator involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the orchestrator is the thing that we call a metadata controller.
Oh, it sounds like we're talking about MAMS now. We're talking about metadata.
Different metadata.
Okay.
Yeah, when we talk about MAMS, metadata is like, who shot this, and what's this of, and what's the codec, and what's the frame rate?
And who's the client, and what's their
all
job code,
and all that things
stuff.
That either get pulled out of the files directly, or
you have an asset tagger putting
the
information in.
Yeah, someone's tagging, logging all of that in there.
But that's not what we're talking about.
No. So metadata really just means data about data, right? That's why we also hear the phrase metadata on the news when we're, talking about, Edward Snowden and stuff, and
mm-hmm.
phone records, and I won't go into that anymore, but there's lots of metadata because in this futuristic IT complex world we live in, Jason, there's lots of data about data. So when we talk about metadata controllers in a SAN environment, the file system itself is the metadata we're talking about, and the instructions that are flowing between clients and this orchestrator computer, it's really typically a pair of computers because they act as kind of in a high availability.
Yeah.
In case one goes down, the other can immediately pick up the act so the whole system doesn't go down. But in a SAN, this metadata controller server, it's not the one that all the information has to flow through in order for it to get written to the file system. You are writing it to the file system. However, it is... think of it in front of a big orchestra, right? It's waving the baton and saying, you, right here, and you, right to this little section of me, so you're not stomping over that other person's data and corrupting the file system.
To get back to our analogy with the mailroom, it's kind of like a user goes into the mailroom and puts a package down, and there's some barcode scanner in there that says, oh, hey, this user put this package here.
Well, I guess I'd put it this way, right? It's like, oh, I'm going to quickly give you a set of directions to get to the mailbox that you want to drop that in. And it's a specific set of directions that I'm generating at this moment in time that prevents you from running into one of those other people who are trying to get to their mailbox.
Okay. Yeah. That's great.
Mm-hmm. So, and that's what the metadata controller does. It's saying right here, right on this little section of my storage, right on this section of my storage, don't collide with what that other person is doing. Because I'm only having one person write to individual blocks of storage. And this is way deep under the covers of hard drive and SAN technology. But you're really preventing users from writing over each other's data. And so the metadata we're talking about in a SAN, it actually flows over an Ethernet network. It's a dedicated network. It's gigabit.
Another dedicated
network. It's not the network that the data flows through. Nor is it your general network. There is yet another Ethernet network. It actually is Ethernet. And this is purely called the metadata network. And it's where the metadata controller servers send this traffic control routing right here, don't right there, moment-to-moment information to all of the clients of the SAN system so their data doesn't overlap and corrupt one another and there aren't collisions and everything just works properly.
Gotcha.
So it's not the general network, and then you have the metadata network. Well, the thing on another layer of the SAN that's special is that it doesn't use Ethernet or for the actual data to flow over. So a SAN uses a different type of network called fiber channel. And fiber channel refers to a specific type of networking switch that's just used for this type of storage area network. They sometimes use copper cables. It's very rare, but they're a totally different form factor. They are typically fiber optic. They're typically fiber optic, and that's where the data flows through. So it's kind of giving the traffic control data through that metadata Ethernet network. The data actually flows over the fiber optic fiber channel network, and then you still have your general network. So there's actually three network involved in a SAN.
Right.
And then there's this metadata controller. there's all these layers of complexity.
It sounds like it's a little complex.
And cost. But you want to know what the nice thing is?
What's that?
It's this big hard drive icon on your desktop that everybody shares that you are directly addressing, really behaves like local storage. Pretty much any program you use is going to think of as local storage. There aren't these bizarre, you know, procedures you have to use to connect to it. And I shouldn't say bizarre, I don't want to overhype it, but it just behaves the way you expect it would. It's, you know, especially for a Mac client, it's like the closest thing to that hard drive icon you just never have to think about. That's very robust, has high uptime, and is just there doing its thing. The fiber channel network that uses fiber optic connectors, and the fiber in fiber channel is typically spelled RE versus the fiber in fiber optics ER, because it's referring to a fiber channel switch network that is kind
it's
of
actually like a protocol name.
It's a protocol name. It doesn't actually even have to do with fiber optics, from what I gather. It has to do with the way that the switches work under the hood.
No, because all of these
it's a
fiber channel
switching network.
All of these fiber channel devices all need to have what we've been calling SFPs, which are transceivers.
Yes, these
little
doohickeys that go into whatever your fiber channel adapter interface is. Whether that's a Thunderbolt box or an internal card.
And when we say HBA, host bus adapter, we're usually talking about
the fiber
either
channel
that Thunderbolt
card.
That Thunderbolt box that does the fiber channel, or the fiber channel card.
Yeah, with Ethernet, we call them NICs, network interface connectors.
Yeah, network interface connectors.
And in fiber channel parlance, we call them HBAs, host bus adapters. But it is that card or box that puts you on that particular type of network. But because we're almost exclusively using fiber optics, you have to have a little doohickey in that box called a transceiver module that literally turns electrons into photons and back and forth again, so you can be communicating data over an optical cable.
Right.
You're not transmitting electrons over a fiber optic cable. It's all photons, but they get translated back to electrons on the switch side, and the RAIDs all speak electrons, so you need these little things. But those are kind of just a little thing at the end of the cables that our clients don't really have to worry about too much. They just need to make sure they have one for every piece of equipment.
Right.
But, you know, this fiber channel network is getting you through the complexity and the engineering and administrative side of things to a level of simplicity on the user side that's very elegant. And, you know, most users these days have one or two 8 gig fiber optic fiber channel connections between themselves and a switch. Two is usually used for redundancy purposes more than
speed.
Exactly. Yeah. But even if you just have one, that 8 gigs of performance, again, if the system behind the scenes is capable of this, you get almost that full 8 gigabits worth of bandwidth, or 1 gigabyte per second for the user.
So it's not this sort of
hamstrung
virtualized, well, we've got to give up some overhead, you know, speed for the overhead of the file system virtualization.
Exactly. It's a much rawer way of the computer communicating with the storage and writing data and reading from the storage. And so because there's way less overhead involved other than that metadata that's flowing, but that's handled on a totally separate network. So it kind of keeps it nice and separate from where the data is flowing. But that network that the data is flowing on is literally just the raw data you might be writing to the drive or reading the drive.
I've said to sort of explain this to people, the fiber is the block level data. The Ethernet metadata network is like the directory. It's like
traffic control.
Exactly. It's actually how you can see the data.
Exactly. And tells you where to write the data.
In a file system on your, you know, on your Mac, for example, that's sort of merged into one and sort of obfuscated from the user. But in a StorNext environment, they're two separate things. And that's one of the reasons it works so well.
Exactly. And it's very highly reliable. We talked about how the metadata controllers are often run as a pair. So they're running in this high availability mode. All of the RAIDs, when we talk about fiber channel networks, typically have redundant controllers. We typically have redundant switches. When we do a StorNext SAN, there are usually almost no, I'm not going to say totally no, but there's usually almost no single points of failure. You could have a metadata controller go down. It's going to fail over to the other one, and a lot of users aren't even going to notice
that
anything
happened.
They won't
even notice the difference. Yeah.
You could have a RAID controller go up on a RAID. It's still going to be running. when we build file servers for people, there tend to be significantly more single points of failure.
Right.
We don't run into those hardware failures that often, but if you have a totally, you know, high uptime requirement in your environment, you're in broadcast, you are, you know, just have a lot of heavy deadlines. Mm-hmm. You've got a ton of users. They're working around the clock. You can't sustain downages. SAN, with all of its additional redundancies that it tends to offer above and beyond your typical file servers, another great advantage. You got better speed and overall performance. You know, the apps like it more because it behaves more like local, storage. The users can think of it more like a local drive. It behaves like a local drive. One thing I should say is we don't get spotlight searching on it.
That's true.
So, and that's again because the file
Let's say that again, Nick. You don't get spotlight searching on a SAN.
Specifically a StorNext/XSAN SAN.
Right. There are applications out there that can that can get you that functionality. You know, a MAM being one of them.
A MAM, or there are some indexing tools that we can use that give you a separate thing that's a lot like Spotlight to search. Mm-hmm. We have a feature of those. Studio Network Solutions actually makes one of those. So those are all options. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the one caveat where it doesn't kind of act like local storage. But the reality is when you get to the amount of capacities most of our SANs have, you're going to need a more sophisticated file management tool than Spotlight just to deal with it anyway.
Right.
You're going to probably want to be looking at a MAM to have things tagged and indexed in a true database and all of that, right?
Right.
But
we hope so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, We do like our MAMs, despite the fact that
we do.
They sometimes pain us.
We like our MAMs, but we like the fact that people are thinking about how they can find this and sometimes in many cases monetize on this, you know, wealth of material they have.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Right? Because, well, we've always talked about MAMs a lot on this show, but you know, there's both the things the MAM does for your organization internally and the things that it can enable for you externally as far as easing distribution and giving your clients a window into the content and remonetizing and all that.
But maybe helping you with workflow, be a workflow engine, help you automate some tasks.
But here's the thing, right? You want a strong foundation under that. And, you know, when someone wants the most robust storage platform possible for high-performance video production workgroup environments, SAN is what we push them towards. But a SAN like StorNext is probably one of the more expensive types of storage that we sell. Now, here's what's interesting. There are manufacturers who sell systems that either are just really fancy NASs, but still present a lot of those same issues that we talked about earlier with NAS to the users, but maybe cost a lot more than a StorNext SAN.
Ah.
Or, and this is interesting, and we do this ourselves sometimes, systems that are really SANs behind the scenes, but then present themselves out to the end users through a NAS front end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, this would be something like EMC's Isilon.
Sure.
You know, Isilon really is a SAN behind the scenes. It has a robust SAN-type file system. It writes data across many, many drives. It can be scaled out. But most users are connecting to it through a file sharing protocol
like NFS.
And you know, maybe 10 gig, but a lot of those would be single gig connections. So there's still a lot of caveats there.
You still have
the
infrastructure caveats.
Exactly,
really.
Exactly. So there's a lot to consider with SANs. NAS, SAN, is one required in your environment? Are there reasons that you would need to move from one to the other? You know,
Let's talk about that for a second. Moving from... I've seen situations where an organization has decided the limitations of a NAS are really not working for them. A lot of times it comes around the time where we decide, hey, we need some more storage. Like we ran, you know, we used up all of our storage. We're at like 85-95% and we need to get some more storage. So, you know, we've been thinking for a while, we want all the benefits of a SAN, so maybe it's time to go in that direction. What parts of the currently existing NAS infrastructure could potentially be like repurposed for the SAN, new SAN environment?
Well, we talked about how in a well-engineered video NAS environment, you're going to have a separate Ethernet network than your general network.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe that switch becomes the metadata Ethernet switch in your SAN environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer what the actual data flows over, but it's still a useful networking switch for the metadata to flow through.
Sure, and these metadata switches don't need to be anything real spectacular, but in a lot of cases, if you went from a NAS environment,
it's
a decent switch, and it's going to suit all those needs.
So you've got that, right?
Mm-hmm. You've also already got the network run, most likely.
Yes.
If you've done a good job and engineered it well.
The cabling issues associated with both of these networking types are nothing to scoff at with
right.
a NAS. You know you're going to need at least one more Ethernet connection between
sure.
the switch location and your client systems. With a SAN, you're going to need that, so the general network, the Ethernet network.
For the metadata.
And the data network, which is going to be
channel.
Fiber optic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, cabling is definitely a thing, and having that second Ethernet run already done that can go from being the NAS storage network
mm-hmm.
over to the SAN metadata network, that's useful.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then the big thing is usually the storage itself, right?
Right, right.
The storage, it would be nice to be able to use those 30 or 50 or 100 terabytes that was previously kind of shared out as a NAS and somehow turning it into a building block of a SAN. And this is one of the things. We talked about how the NASs we build tend to be these kind of self-constructed servers
right.
running the OpenE software. For SANs, because we like them to have high availability, we generally use a third-party commercial product as it has to be fiber channel storage.
Right.
It has to have mm-hmm. RAID controllers with fiber channel ports on them. And these days, I'd say the two primary ones we use are NexSans storage, which
mm-hmm.
we've talked about on this program and,
yep.
and we often put into environments, and Quantum's own QX series of
yeah.
storage, which
mm-hmm.
is also just fiber channel RAIDs, right?
Yep.
And that may have been the storage we sold you for a NAS, and we may have taken that tier of storage with its redundant RAID controllers and everything and put it behind a server acting as the server head node, the file
sure.
server.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what your NAS is, in which case it's pretty easy to repurpose the storage, although I have to be very clear, because we need to put the SAN file system on it, we're going to have to back up all your data and blow it up, you know, figuratively.
Yeah.
But we have to back up the data.
So there's
wipe out the data on it and then fold it back into the new SAN
yeah.
architecture.
So there's a data migration step there.
But we might
right.
do that, or if you had purchased one of our OpenE units, one of our file server kind of appliances.
Tuned for file storage.
Which,
right.
yes, we may have put in as a file server initially, and so we outfitted it, say, with several 10 gigabit Ethernet ports to connect it to that video-specific Ethernet network. But we actually can convert those into fiber channel RAID storage as well, because one of the things
right.
that OpenE can do, in addition to acting as a file server, is that it can actually be the management software for what essentially becomes a fiber channel RAID. Now, the one we sold you as a file server, which had a single motherboard and a single RAID controller, you know, several other single things in it, isn't going to present the high availability with the dual redundant, what they call active RAID controllers that we would often put into a SAN. But we've definitely put OpenEs into SAN environments
sure.
even with their single
yes,
points
we have.
Of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we'd have to back up all the data onto one of our RAIDs, wipe out the OpenE box, put in a fiber channel card, because again, on a SAN, we'll
yep.
need a fiber channel card for the storage to connect to the fiber channel switches, which the clients
mm-hmm.
and the metadata controllers are also connected to. And then we could add it as a building block of the SAN and then add more on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, once that's done, transfer your data back to it. And we may say, because again, not always do SANs just present as a single drive. We may have SANs that are several volumes, that
sure.
are several
yeah.
drives.
You might
really
have a drive for each, a volume for each work group.
And so we may set your NAS up as one volume of a SAN
mm-hmm.
and then have new storage, maybe high availability storage that we fold in, like a NexSAN or a QX from Quantum Unit that has the redundant RAID controllers and
mm-hmm.
all that. It's really like two computers in one, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We might fold that in as the new storage in a SAN environment so you get the benefits from that high availability and that high performance, but say, well, here's your original volume, and maybe you treat this as kind of nearline because it
sure.
is potentially more subject to going offline if a part fails. you might not want to put projects that are being worked on now. Maybe it becomes a disk-based archive tier.
Or maybe use it for proxies for your MAM.
Proxies. Mm-hmm. It could act as a backup to a primary SAN
volume.
Sync volume
if it's large enough.
Yeah, if we want to replicate your production volume over to another just for failover purposes. So
I do find that in a lot of the transitions we've done that they're more successful if we add a SAN pull of storage and migrate from the NAS to the SAN. And that way, you know, you're migrating from old storage to new storage. There's not a point where you're like down and you can't use the storage because the migration's happening.
This leads, I think, to, one of the last points I think we ought to make here, right? Which is that in a lot of our clients' environments, they use both of these technologies and often at the same time.
Sure.
And that may be true if you started with a NAS and want to adopt a SAN. You don't have to stop using the NAS. Because you no longer probably have it on a dedicated Ethernet network for live video work, it may inherently become kind of tier two storage.
Sure.
That's on your general network.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that it's not addressable. It's just that you might not be doing live editing off of it all the time. But it might still be a useful repository. And so a lot of our clients will have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. They might have a SAN for production purposes. And maybe have a MAM that's really just used as kind of the front end towards archive and tape archive, but it has a disk tier, like a silo of storage that's like kind of the disk side of archive. There's a MAM managing just that stuff, and then tape library connected to it. And so you may have what the NAS essentially becomes something that you only interact with through the MAM.
Right.
And it's there under the hood as kind of the MAM's cache storage, if you will.
Right, a nearline.
So,
disk to disk to tape.
Exactly. There's a lot of ways you can do these environments. And again, sometimes you can get away with either technology. Sometimes there's just a lot of reasons why one seems to be the appropriate one in your environment. And it's not always the SAN. It's sometimes the NAS just makes the most sense for you.
Right.
There's a client that we're talking with now where there's just a preponderance of factors, some of them budgetary, because NASs can be done more cheaply than SANs. But it just seems like a NAS might be a good fit for them. There's other environments where we wouldn't even think to sell them anything other than a StorNext SAN. Some of our big broadcast customers who have operations that are going around the clock. In fact, for some of those types of folks, we might sell them multiple SANs with multiple sets of metadata controller servers, where if a live feed is being ingested, we might set it up so someone is ingesting onto both SAN volumes simultaneously. So if for whatever reason, these things are not 100% infallible, if something went down, they still wouldn't lose the capture, right?
Right.
So
I've seen sync volumes, SANs that are set up as sync volumes.
Absolutely.
Two completely separate SANs. One is syncing to the other one.
Yep.
So
there's a lot of things we do, and obviously it's our clients talking to us and having some pretty deep conversations that leads to us make maybe one or even multiple recommendations. And we usually try to say, listen, we're not going to put something in front of you that we don't think would meet your needs. However, let's explain the differences and what will be affected day to day if you go this route versus that route, right?
Right.
Here's a NAS. We think this will work, but here's your caveats. And you're going to really need to make sure that you can break down for us who your power users are, who might need 10 gig, and who can get away with single gig. We're not going to make guesses about this. You need to be willing to engage with us in the conversation.
Right.
If you don't want to think about it, then you're going to have to spend more money so we can put something in that we know inherently will have more overhead than
Absolutely.
You really know what to do with. But, if you want to have a nuanced conversation, which we're always happy to have, then maybe other things become possible.
Sure.
But we really kind of demand those conversations of our customers because we can't guess about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to guess that a NAS connecting to your clients over single gigabit is going to work, because who's going to be the first people who get the phone call when people start dropping frames because it wasn't spec'd out adequately, because you said that you only needed 3 streams of XDCAM 50 at once per client, but, we decided to do this project in Red Code. That might make a difference.
That sure would make a difference.
There's some performance differences between Red Code and XDCAM HD, right?
Sure.
So, but yeah, people don't often think of this stuff. I mean, some do, but mm-hmm. some don't. And, you know, we really like to make sure that the technology we put in that is the bedrock of the organization, your storage, because your data is like the most important thing, your people and your data. You can replace computers.
Yep.
You can't necessarily replace people, and you definitely can't replace your data if it's lost. That may have been a unique thing that isn't going to get redone.
Yep.
And so, you know, we take this stuff seriously. Mm-hmm. We like to build some scaling into every system we
sure.
do. You can start on a single gig NAS system and move to 10 gig at some point,
mm-hmm.
or start just a couple of systems on 10 gig and fold in more 10 gig over time when you have more budget that opens up for a bigger 10 gig Ethernet switch. As we talked about, you could start with a NAS and still move over to a SAN either by adding it or turning it into a SAN later mm-hmm. on. We can build smaller SANs at first. And
sure.
one of the great things about SANs is they're very easy
very
to add to.
Mm-hmm.
We can add storage space that both ups the space of the SAN and gives you greater back-end performance on the SAN at once. And it
yeah,
can be like
yeah.
an hour or two of downtime, and the users
sure.
come back, and then the SAN is just
the SAN's
bigger,
bigger
and faster.
Yeah. That's one distinction I wanted to make. A lot of times with NASs, this isn't all NAS systems, but with the basic NAS systems, what happens when you run out of storage and you just, we're not going to archive, we're going to add storage.
We can add storage to a NAS, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when we add, because again, think about these shares, mm-hmm. these things that are these virtual volumes that you connect to using SIFS or NFS. These shares will originally set up. And let's say we sell our file server that is the one that holds 36 hard drives in a mm-hmm. 4-rack U unit. And let's say we set them up as one big group of drives, and they're all presented as a single share.
Mm-hmm.
We can add drives through an expansion chassis later on,
mm-hmm.
and even associate them with that share. But the thing is, we're not really upping the aggregate performance of the share, because I think the way it works, someone will correct me if I'm wrong here on my own team side, but I think when we add drives to a share post facto, it kind of fills up the original group and then flows over to the next group.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the performance of the share kind of becomes the performance of the new set of drives. And of course, you can draw on some of the performance from the old set, but it's never going to really outperform the original set.
Right. And I would think that one of the reasons an organization might say, we want to add some storage is maybe they've grown their team a little bit. Maybe they've had to add a few workstations.
Maybe.
So
maybe.
There may be an increased bandwidth requirement then too at that point.
So again, with SAN, SANs give us the most flexible way because, again, the way that those file systems are written to inherently kind of allow for multiple users. Well, one of the other nice things about SAN file systems is that they're very good at allowing you to fold in additional storage and have a very elegant way of having that add to the performance and space of that whole mm-hmm. file system.
That, yep.
Again, that thing that will just look like a drive, right? And we use these terms kind of interchangeably. Drive, we're not always just referring to the hard drives. We're referring to the drive icon.
The icon on the desktop.
That drive yeah. icon is a volume,
mm-hmm.
which we sometimes say is a file system,
right?
Because there's yeah. one file system that determines a volume. It's what kind of turns one or more hard drives into the volume is mm-hmm. the file system on it. And we may also refer to a namespace. It is
right.
a volume that has a particular volume name associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, SAN file systems are typically really good at allowing you to add space and performance under that same namespace.
That same namespace.
In a
yeah.
way that to the users is just totally seamless. They show up tomorrow and, the SAN's twice as big.
Twice
That's
as
nice.
Big. Yeah.
There's more nuance involved when doing it with a NAS that's typically a little less glorious.
Sure. Let's talk really quick about reshares.
Sure.
When you have a SAN, you may have, your production team that wants to access the SAN 24/7, all the time. And then you may have a couple of fringe users. Maybe they just need to pull assets every once in a while
yep.
that maybe we can't afford to invest in the infrastructure
yep.
to make them full on SAN clients. Can we have like a machine somewhere on the network that is attached to the SAN, say share that out as a NAS to somebody else?
Remember how I said there are some manufacturers that almost specialize in building SANs that only get presented out to the clients as NASs?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we actually do that ourselves with StorNext sometimes. It's really under those types of circumstances that you just outlined. It might be a graphics user or an audio user who's doing more like pushing and pulling content.
Sure.
Maybe they're working locally, right? Because Pro Tools is at least most predictable when you're using local storage.
Mm-hmm.
But they still need to be able to like pull a video file down.
Sure.
But they don't necessarily need the fiber channel connection to do that. Well, sometimes we'll build a SAN. We'll make one of the clients a server that itself is now connected to the SAN file system and is resharing some or all, usually some, of the SAN,
mm-hmm.
maybe a particular directory or a set of directories, as shares using SMB SIFS
sure.
and NFS. And it's basically turning a portion of the SAN for some users into a NAS.
Right.
And that's where the rules of the NAS kind of come back up again.
Sure.
Yep. You know, there are potentially more latencies involved. There is more of a performance bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
But you may have an environment, and we've done this quite regularly over the years. In fact, I'd say in most of the bigger environments we cater to, you know, at least half of them are probably sharing out at least a small portion of the SAN
mm-hmm.
over Ethernet as a NAS.
Right.
You know,
right.
So other fringe users, you know, at the periphery of things can kind of still have some data exchange with the SAN users, but they don't necessarily need all that high performance.
Yeah.
So we kind of create a hybrid environment where the SAN is a SAN to most users. But for some users, there's this gateway in between. It is a file server.
I've heard it referred to as the NAS head.
The NAS head.
Yeah.
It is a SAN client, but mm-hmm. then it virtualizes a portion of the SAN out for another set of users.
Right.
So that gives us obviously the most flexibility.
Sure.
Because then on a user-by-user basis, we can say, well, you clearly need to be a SAN user. You need to be a SAN user. You could be a NAS user. You could be a SAN user. You three over there could be NAS users.
Mm-hmm.
And there is the cost of that file server box, but they're not hugely expensive. It's a server, right?
Right.
And that way we can bring down the costs on a lot of users mm-hmm. by not having to have fiber channel HBAs, less cabling needs to be run out to them, and they still get the performance they need, but in a way that allows them to seamlessly exchange data with the same SAN storage environment that the SAN users are on.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a whole cool. lot of options.
Yeah, sounds like it.
We got options.
We got options. Yes, we do, Mr. Gold. We have lots of options.
So I think we've probably blown most people's minds here. NASs and SANs, SANs and NAS, they're not the same, but they can live in harmony.
Yes.
Together with hugs.
Just like the little icon on the desktop with the people holding hands.
Yeah.
The little NAS icon.
Shared storage. Yay. Yay. So thank everyone for listening.
Thank you.
And thank you for asking all these great questions.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's a good
clarification. Thank you for answering all these great questions.
I tried. If I lied about anything, you know, feel free to send an email to Jason Whetstone at Jessa.com. And we definitely will get into some of those issues we were hinting at with directory services, users, groups,
permissions.
That's a biggie.
Yes.
Maybe we'll bring in the heavy artillery for that conversation.
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, thanks, folks, for listening to another episode of The Workflow Show, and we will speak with you soon. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
The Workflow Show is a production of Chesapeake Systems. We welcome your comments and suggestions for upcoming episodes. You can email us at workflowshow@chesa.com. That's workflowshow@chesa.com. And if you'd like to talk with a member of our team of experts about your particular digital media workflow needs, email us at prosales@chesa.com. That's prosales@chesa.com. We appreciate your listening to The Workflow Show, and we'll catch you next time.